Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or at Banking Day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 44 in our series for 2023, and today's date is Friday, December the 1st. First, I'll be talking to Tom Cornell, the head of assessments for APAC at Hireview, about how Aussies can prepare for the Great Resignation. Several factors contributed to the Great Resignation, and while the pandemic played a crucial role, other underlying issues are also at play. While the Great Resignation gained attention in 2021, it's essential to recognise that the labour market is complex and multiple factors contribute to employment trends. The phenomenon also highlights the changing expectations of workers and the need for employers to adapt to evolving preferences and priorities in the workforce. Tom is a hiring expert with a background in psychometrics and IO psychology, and he'll shed light on how the Great Resignation will affect Australian business. And I'll be talking to RMIT economist Sinclair Davidson about how the infrastructure spending by federal and state governments are affecting inflation. But first, let's talk to Tom Cornell.
Tom, tell us, what is the Great Resignation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the Great Resignation is really a, I don't know if you call it a movement or a shift or a trend we're seeing in that there's been a greater amount of individuals looking to leave their current jobs or pursue new career opportunities. Yeah, really, the term was actually coined a couple of years back. It predates the COVID pandemic. We've seen a big increase in entrepreneurship as well, which is quite interesting. I think a lot of people who, again, just that time spent at home, able to plan and think about the future, has meant that that's given them the extra push they needed to pursue, you know, their side hustle and perhaps take their business from being an idea into something tangible. I think so. There's a lot of excitement about trying something new and thinking about what you can be doing differently. And I think people are really starting to think about what's important to them, what really matters. And you know, we're living in a time when that kind of 9 to 5, Monday to Friday grind is really being challenged. I mean, I think it's a whole different discussion point altogether, but you think about the 4-day working week that's being trialed and is seeing some success. I think people are starting to question, you know, do I actually want to spend, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week in the office, having spent maybe an hour commuting there?
Well, that raises another issue. That creates a hybrid work model. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see a trend towards that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, a lot of people have had that experience of working from home. I think a lot of people have perhaps adapted to that. I think certainly for some people, it's harder than others. I mean, I don't have young children, so I know some of my colleagues found it more difficult to actually, hey, now I've got to do everything at home the full time. So while on one hand, perhaps being enforced to have to work from home is quite challenging, having the flexibility and the freedom to choose when and if you go into the office, I think is quite valuable for a lot of people. I think that people are really missing a lot of the social interaction that, of course, being in an office does provide. Everything when you're having to do it over sort of Zoom or WebEx, everything's planned, it's structured. You're not going to just reach out to someone and say, hey, do you want to jump on a Zoom for 2 minutes and just have a bit of a natter? So I think some of those small interactions that we miss, people will want to get from being able to go in the office every now and then. And so I think that's, I think Australia has always been quite good at that. Australia's always ranked quite highly in terms of offering sort of working from home and flexible working arrangements. But I certainly think we're seeing a bit of a shift towards that globally.
So what you're suggesting is we're moving towards, well, based on that model, we're talking about an employees market where it will give them more power looking for work.
Absolutely. I think that is really what we're seeing. There's more of an onus on the employer to make the working environment and the role itself more attractive to not only prospective but also current employees, to not only draw that talent in but actually to retain them. I think that we're seeing a lot more confidence from employees to push and to ask more from their employers. If we think a few sort of decades back, it was very common to have this idea of a job for life. You get a job and that offers you structure, stability. You can work your way up the ranks over the years and your pay will come with that. Whereas actually now people are starting to question that. They're moving jobs perhaps every few years, joining startups, trying something new. We're kind of moving away from this idea that employees should be grateful. I'm so thankful that I've got this job with this company. I don't want to put any risk to that. I think people are feeling more confident about taking risks and trying something new. Certainly sped up over the last couple of years. I just had to think that COVID and the shift to everything going digital, that of course has sped things up a little bit. But I think that certainly coming from, I guess, my background being around the assessment space, certainly predates the pandemic by a few years, this focus on kind of candidate experience. The idea, again, that you can't expect candidates to just jump through multiple hoops and say, well, oh, they want to get this job, they'll do it. We started to see a shift away from multiple rounds of interviews and these traditional long-form assessments and candidates saying, hey, actually, we're not happy with this. So a lot of organizations are putting a big focus on improving that candidate experience. And we're also now seeing that then translate into saying, well, hold on, it's not enough to focus on your prospective employees and make sure that they're happy with the process. You've also got to make sure that you're able to maintain and retain them once they're in the organization. I was looking at this, I was looking about a little while back around sort of candidate experience as a search trend in Google started picking up in around 2009. But employee experience actually started coming in a lot later, like 2015, 2016. So maybe they're kind of playing a bit of catch up around saying we need to focus on the entire human experience rather than just on the candidate.
Well, this has huge implications for businesses. I mean, how can they actually build a workforce and maintain a workforce in that climate? And what adjustments do they have to make is more to the point.
Well, I think it's as important that they make sure that they are listening to their employees and what really matters and is valued by them. There's certainly plenty of research around different generations and what they tend to value. Generally, your sort of older generations would value stability and opportunities to generate wealth, whereas the more sort of the newer generations entering the workforce now, they might have a greater emphasis on work-life balance and sort of opportunities created by your work, perhaps living and traveling abroad. So you can get some general rules and these are the kind of things people are looking for, but that doesn't replace actually speaking to your workforce, having your manager engaging and saying, hey, we know things are tough. We know things are going on right now that none of us expected. What can we be doing to make things easier for you and to ultimately make you happier?
Right. Okay. But conversely, it would mean the organization would have to be much more in tune with what their workforce is on about and to actually be providing opportunities to move as well. Would that be right?
I don't think necessarily just opportunities to move. I don't think that's obviously the only thing that people are necessarily looking for, although I certainly do think that the shift to that hybrid workforce is creating a trend in that direction. But I think that it's almost not too much to ask. I mean, employers are often saying, hey, we want people who are really agile, who are really flexible. That's that agile mindset is something we're hearing employers say. We want that in our workforce. We want that in our new employees. And so I don't think it's so much for those employees to kind of flip that back on the employer and say, well, great, you want me to be agile and flexible, but that also means I want you to be agile and flexible to what I want and to how I want to do things.
Well, the issue is how can employees improve their chances of landing a job?
Yeah, I mean, I think what employers are looking for, we haven't seen a significant shift in terms of the process from the pandemic. I mean, as I say, a couple of things like resilience and that agile mindset when people are having to be able to work from home, we've seen a bit of an uptick in that. But ultimately, the processes are largely the same, interviews and assessments. But they have, of course, moved to a more digital modality. So I think for candidates who are looking for the job, ultimately, the process is the same. You need to understand the company, you want to understand the role. thinking about what you have to offer and to time that in, just the same as if you're doing it face-to-face over the phone or via a virtual interview. That hasn't really fundamentally changed. What I think is also important is that people really consider the transferable skills that they've been able to develop and learn during the pandemic. I think that people have had very different experiences over the last 18 months. You know, some people have lost their job. Some people have perhaps out of necessity had to move into a totally different area because the area they were working in before, it just collapsed as an industry. And so I think that people can take a real focus on, okay, what have I learned from that, rather than simply saying, well, I did this the last 18 months and that defines me. And I think that goes both ways, right? I think not only from a candidate looking for a job, need to consider the more transferable skills rather than the experience for experience sake. I think employers need to remember, we can't make any assumptions about anyone's personal experience or why they made certain choices over the last 18 months. We can't assume anything about that. So focusing on what they bring to the table, the skills they have, the capabilities, rather than their latest job title or their work experience from the last 18 months is really important.
And of course, many people would have picked up valuable skills.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, certainly I think the first lockdown, everyone I knew was saying, oh, I'm learning to bake banana bread, I'm going to learn a new language. And I think by this one, people were perhaps not quite so optimistic. So I think, look, it's not as much as saying, oh, well, I didn't spend all my spare time learning a new technology. I think that, while everyone might have started with a great ambition, the reality of lockdown quickly fitted in. But certainly still people have been doing other things, people are getting involved in different ways in the community, or even just how you've had to adapt to working from home. That actually can show some resilience and some agility. So I think people absolutely have a lot of positive things that they can bring out from the lockdowns that they can then apply to the workforce.
And working from home, you'd pick up a whole lot of other skills as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that, as I said, I don't have children myself, but I certainly know that some of my colleagues who do, they've certainly had to, you're taking on that kind of people management, that structuring their time and being able to quickly jump off a call to do some homeschooling.
Yeah.
Something like that demonstrates a lot of capacity that you may not have been able to demonstrate previously.
Well, Tom, that's all quite illuminating, and thank you very much for your time.
No, thanks for having me. It's been great to speak to you.
And now let's talk to RMIT economist Sinclair Davidson.
Well, Sinclair, the government's been in a whole lot of trouble with infrastructure, and they've brought in a new program to scale back the production because it's causing labour shortages and inflation. What's your view about that?
There's a whole bunch of things going on here at the moment, Leon. I mean, for a start, bearing in mind, we do have an inflationary problem. Inflation is running well above the Reserve Bank's range of 2-3%. This has been happening for a while. We've got changes at the Reserve Bank, so we've got a new governor as well. So how she responds to inflation is also sort of an open question at the moment. And I think we should just step back and just remind ourselves where this inflation came from. So a couple of years ago, governments around the world locked down economies, paid people a whole bunch of money to stay at home, and we didn't have a lot of productive activity. So that inflation originates more or less from the COVID lockdowns. To be fair to the Reserve Bank, they were slow in responding to those inflationary pressures because there were arguments at the time that the price changes that we were seeing were just a story about disrupted supply chains. I wasn't entirely convinced by that story, but I do think it's a fair enough story for the Reserve Bank to actually have not immediately responded to inflationary pressures. But here we are, they are with us now. The challenge that we face is that one of the contributors to inflation is irresponsible spending. Now, a lot of people make the argument that we have a story about too much money chasing too few goods. The real issue is how does that money get into the economy? So think of the idea of empty calories. We've got good spending and we've got bad spending. The good spending is either consumption, private consumption, or government spending that adds to productive capacity. And the bad spending is government spending that doesn't add to productive capacity. The government at the moment has taken the view that a lot of the infrastructure spend that's been undertaken is probably excessive, or they are building to too high a standard than what they otherwise should be doing. So they want to cut back on the amount of money they are pumping into the economy so that it becomes more consistent with the level of productive spending that we can expect. That is the logic behind their argument. Whether or not they actually succeed is a very different question. That is the logic. It seems to me fair enough. We should stop spending so much money, but we should stop spending not so much money just on infrastructure. But at the moment, government spending is also subsidizing a lot of consumption. So Mr. Chalmers and Mr. Albanese need to have a good, long, hard look at their next budget. What is government spending money on?
This is not only true of the federal governments chasing infrastructure, but also state government budgets.
Absolutely. The states and the federal government do need to get their, you know, their stories consistent and do need to become synchronized. I've seen a lot of news in the last week of the state governments heavily criticizing the federal government. And of course, this is how our federalism works. States and federal governments are supposed to be criticizing each other. But certainly, I think the state governments also do need to be making more of an effort to actually rein in some of their excessive infrastructure spending. And a lot of the spending that was initiated before COVID may be less necessary now after COVID. So they do need to all have a long, hard look at what they're doing.
But certainly some of it was certainly in the case of what was then the Andrews government with their chasing infrastructure at that time and all the excessive building that was going. That certainly became like a hallmark of that regime, that this is what we're doing for you.
Yes.
And this is what we're leaving you. Because we're such a productive government.
Yes, the challenge with the Andrews government was that they had some very early infrastructure successes. They removed a lot of the boom gates and actually caused traffic to flow much easier. They did a lot of spending there. There were a lot of traffic bottlenecks that were relieved when they did all that spending. Before COVID, they decided to start building a second city loop. Now, before COVID, that was probably a good idea. After COVID, it's probably less of a good idea, but we're kind of now in the sunk cost fallacy. There are whole bits of the CBD that have been sort of cordoned off for future train stations. Now, ideally, you would mothball that particular project until it becomes necessary again sometime in the future. But what do you do with the cordoned off CBD area? You can't uncordon it off. There's great big holes in the ground that just that either need to be filled up or blocked over or something. So they're kind of stuck in a situation as to, you know, do we double down and just finish it, even though we might not need it for another 10 years or so. Think of the tunnel underneath the Westgate Bridge. The Westgate area is an absolute traffic nightmare at the moment, but it's not clear to me how you can mothball that project for a significant period of time. So they are kind of stuck. They were caught unawares like everybody else was with the COVID crisis. It's not obvious to me how they immediately fix that problem, but yes, it is a problem.
Similarly, they would regard it as a great political thing to build infrastructure.
It was because people like infrastructure. You can see infrastructure. One of the sort of the political economy arguments around infrastructure is, I think it was the mayor of Chicago, Dewey, once said, you've got to spend the money where the people can see it. And infrastructure is where you can see the money being spent. The road outside my house got retarred last year, even though it didn't need retarring. But they retarred the road and there's these big signs saying, your state government has retarred your road. You should be grateful. We're not actually, but that's not the point. It's very hard to criticize a government for retiring a road or for fixing potholes or for building another bridge. So these things are politically popular, even though very often it results in unnecessary expenditure. And we are seeing the price of that unnecessary expenditure right now in the inflation numbers.
And those inflation numbers are taking it very sticky and they're not going down very quickly at all.
They are not going down very quickly at all. And there's a combination of factors here. Fairly or unfairly, we've got a Labor government and people kind of think that Labor governments are going to be less willing to pursue spending cuts and fiscal consolidation. So the inflation expectations get built into people's forecasts of the future. Plus, there has been some turmoil around the Reserve Bank. The Reserve Bank governor changed. We've got a new Reserve Bank governor. It's very unfair to suspect that she's going to be any softer on inflation than her predecessor was. But nonetheless, there is that thought that she might be. So people are going to have to observe the Reserve Bank for a while being tough on inflation before they temper back their inflationary expectations.
And is there too much expectation on the Reserve Bank to cut inflation? Because I mean, that's just the only mechanism they have is raising interest rates and penalises certain people who are on mortgages, but other people get benefits from it. So you know, it's not a complete black and white picture. But should the government be doing stuff with fiscal policy?
Yes.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's R-E-B-A-G.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The government should be doing things with fiscal policy in addition to having higher interest rates. As I've said to you before, Leon, raising interest rates is the economic equivalent of medical bleeding. You know, in the bad old days, you would slice somebody's wrists and you would bleed some blood out, and then you would tape them up, and hopefully the patient didn't die in the meantime. This is the economic equivalent of bleeding, but there are other things that can be done. So at the moment, in addition to monetary policy, which is tightening up, at the moment, still we have too loose fiscal policy. So we actually have government spending and borrowing too much money at the minute. And the fiscal theory of inflation is that the value of the currency appreciates or depreciates to equalize the real value of government debt relative to spending and taxation. So the governments do actually need to spend less money, and more importantly, they need to borrow less money. And you start off by borrowing less, by spending less. To be fair, the current government is looking at some levels of expenditure, so they are cutting back on infrastructure expenditure. They are threatening to tighten up on things such as the NDIS and so on, but there is a lot more that actually needs to be done. We need to be looking at the full gamut of expenditure. So for example, can we really afford those submarines that we're buying from the Americans? And I've kind of put it to you that we probably can't. So all levels of government expenditure should be opened up and had a look at, and we've got to actually stop spending money. Now, when I say spending money, I actually mean the government needs to stop writing checks, because a lot of people say, take the view that spending money is giving subsidies or not collecting taxation or what have you. Spending money in this particular instance means the government needs to stop writing checks to people and needs to stop borrowing on international markets. That's what they really need to do. But in order to do that, they need to look at other things that they are doing. So we need a whole of government approach. And as I said before, fairly or unfairly, Labour governments are viewed, generally speaking, as less willing to do that sort of thing.
And politically, that could be quite an issue for the government.
It is. And bearing in mind, we've got a first-term government, and we're halfway through the first term of a new government. And halfway through the first term of every new government, there's a bit of a wobble when the honeymoon period runs out and everybody realizes they've actually got to work hard to stay in government. So things start becoming a bit tough. And going into your first re-election, no politician wants to be seen as being mean-hearted or remember the John Howard expression, mean and tricky. So the political challenges for the government are real, and they are serious. And they do need to start thinking a lot harder than sort of the wishful thinking that got them elected in the first place.
Yes, less hubris.
Much, much less hubris. But bearing in mind, we are dealing with politicians, and hubris is actually part of the set that you get when you get a politician, and especially first term government. There's a lot of hubris when they arrive, and we're halfway through the session where all of a sudden they start realizing, well, you know, the population aren't as happy with them as they thought, and tough decisions need to be made. These are sort of the normal run of the mill. And it just so happens that all of these factors are sort of coinciding at the same time. So fun times ahead.
Well, Sinclair, thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
So what's happening in the news? Well, inflation has decelerated in the year to October from 5.6% the month before, ahead of the Reserve Bank's last board meeting of a year on Tuesday. The welcome and sharp decline in the annual growth rate of consumer prices comes after surging energy and fuel prices drove annual inflation higher in August and September. The latest figures from the Australian Bureau of Statistics come after the RBA hiked rates to 4.35% on Melbourne Cup Day, citing a growing concern that consumer price growth was proving stickier than hoped. Investors are pricing a 10% chance of another rate rise next week, and economists believe that any further tightening is more likely to come in February. And Treasurer Jim Chalmers will next week begin the biggest overhaul of the Reserve Bank since its inception, including creating a new board to set official interest rates, increasing the governor's independence, and narrowing the bank's mandate to control the inflation and keeping unemployment as low as possible. Chalmers will introduce to Parliament a series of changes to the RBA's 64-year-old governing legislation that will also give the bank new powers to deal with emerging payment systems such as Apple Pay and Google Pay. The coalition is likely to support much of the legislation, as the major parties seek to avoid any minor party tinkering, but there are concerns within the Liberal Party about government appointments to the boards that will oversee both the bank and monetary policy. The review of the Reserve Bank, released in April, recommended sweeping changes to the institution, which, unlike its overseas peers, had not undergone an independent valuation since the early 1980s. The biggest single change will be the creation of a board that will set official interest rates, while a governance board will oversee the RBA's day-to-day operation. The Reserve's 1,575 staff are involved in operations, such as the nation's payment systems, rather than economists and analysts. The review argued a separate monetary policy board would bring Australia into line with world's best practice and enable its members to focus more intently on the state of the economy and interest rates. The RBA practice of meeting monthly, which is unlike almost every other major central bank in the world, will be replaced with a move to 8 2-day meetings a year. And Jim Chalmers has appointed Bank of England official Andrew Houser as the Reserve Bank's next deputy governor, filling a role that has been empty since Governor Michelle Bullock was promoted to the top job in mid-September, and as the central bank undergoes its biggest overhaul in a generation. Mr. Houser's appointment was confirmed in a cabinet meeting on Monday morning to take on a role that will grant him a vote on interest rate decisions affecting millions of mortgage households. The 30-year veteran of the BOE is currently Executive Director for Markets, responsible for managing the BOE's balance sheet and the United Kingdom's Foreign Exchange Reserve, and has held a range of senior positions, including representing the United Kingdom as a member of the IMF's Executive Board in Washington, D.C. He'll be the first foreigner to hold such a position within the bank. The Treasurer in the statement said Mr. Houser brought international expertise in economics and central bank operations, days ahead of Labor introducing legislation as part of a process to reinvigorate and refresh the RBA. And a court has awarded indemnity costs against war veteran Ben Robert Smith for the entirety of his failed defamation case against Nine Entertainment. The civil case was dismissed in the federal court in June, where Justice Anthony Bosanko found there were substantial truth to allegations of four murders in Afghanistan and the bullying of a Special Air Service Regiment SAS colleague. Since then, a complicated battle over who foots the huge legal bill has unfolded. Indemnity costs compensate a successful party to a higher level than what a court would more commonly order after a legal case. Mr. Robert Smith previously accepted he should pay costs on an indemnity basis only as far back as March 2020, when the publisher made a second offer to settle. In my opinion, the applicant should pay the respondent's costs assessed on an indemnity basis from the commencement of the proceedings, Justice Bosanko said in a written decision. The case was initiated in August 2018. Journalist Chris Masters, one of the respondents, has previously said it took 5 years and about $30 million to defend the case. And ASIC-listed Seven West Media's and TV network will continue paying the rent of former Liberal staffer and accused rapist Bruce Learman in Sydney until June next year. In return for interviews, he gave its flagship Spotlight Investigations program. The revelation emerged in cross-examination in the New South Wales Federal Court on Tuesday afternoon in the defamation case he's brought against Network 10 and its former star journalist Lisa Wilkinson. And Origin Energy will hold talks with foreign suitors, Brookfield and EIG, about whether the pair could improve their $20 billion takeover bid amid doubts over the value of a Plan B lobbed last week. The company's board has already said a revised offer appears inferior after a last-minute deal was tabled on Wednesday night, which led to a scheme meeting on Thursday being delayed. Origin Energy's board is leaning towards rejecting the Plan B proposal lobbed by its suitors, Canada's Brookfield and its private equity partner EIG, as a last-ditch attempt to buy the ASX-listed electricity and gas giant. It may now look to test whether an alternative bid could be brought to the table given the complexity and questions over valuations from the current offer. The board has yet to settle on a position on Sunday, but held reservations over aspects of the reworked offer and may look to hold further talks before reconvening for a final decision. One option may look at whether any middle ground could be found between the investor suitors and Australian Super. Origin's largest shareholder, whose opposition to the original pitch largely sunk the buyout. Brookfield and EIG late on Wednesday submitted a revised offer that will see shareholders offered $9.43 a share, but if that bid is rejected by shareholders, Brookfield and EIG have proposed an alternative structure that sees shareholders offered $9.08 a share. And the millions of Australians and thousands of businesses left without phone and internet service during the crippling Optus outage are being asked to make submissions to a government-led review aimed at better safeguarding the country in case of future incidents. About 10 million people and 400,000 businesses were impacted during the November the 8th outage. A separate Greens-led Senate inquiry earlier this month heard from the former chief executive, Coley Bayard Rosmarin, before she quit, that more than 200 triple O calls could not be made while Optus customers were left without service. The review will report on and make recommendations regarding the function of triple O during the outage and will look whether reforms are needed. Communications Minister Michelle Rowland said the review was an opportunity for industry, government and the community to consider what lessons could be learnt from the outage, noting that no network is immune. Optus confirmed changes to routing information after a routine software upgrade was behind the national outage. And Optus is appealing a court ruling that could lead to the release of a forensic report into last year's cyber attack, as a Commonwealth review into this month's phone and internet outage gets underway. Optus is trying to stop class action law firm Slater and Gordon getting hold of a report that the Telecommunications Group commissioned from Deloitte into its 2022 cyber attack, which led to the personal information of some 10,200 customers being posted online. Earlier this month, the Federal Court's Justice Jonathan Beach ruled that Optus could not claim legal professional privileges to keep the full report secret. The court, which said Optus may be able to redact some of the part of the Deloitte report, ordered the telco group to give the report to Slater and Gordon unless it successfully appealed the judge's decision. Slater and Gordon wants to use the Deloitte report in a class action case that alleges the telecoms group failed to protect the personal information of its customers. Class Action's practice group leader, Ben Hardwick, said it was disappointing that the Optus appeared to be refusing to accept the umpire's decision. Our clients who were impacted by this data breach just want this case to move forward, and Optus is putting up another roadblock to their path to justice, Mr. Hardwick said. Former Optus chief executive, Kelly Bay Rosmarin, who resigned on November the 17th, told the Senate inquiry that the Deloitte report was highly sensitive because it contained a forensic investigation into the company's cyber defences. And cost of living expenses are having more impact on domestic tourism than international, as travellers save their money for trips abroad. Tourism Research Australia's annual five-year forecast, released on Tuesday, says domestic travel has gone backwards in 2023 after a strong rebound in 2022. The number of domestic visitor nights is forecast to fall 4.1% this year compared to last year, and still be down 2.6% on 2022 levels by 2027. Increased competition from international outbound travel and cost of living pressures leading to reduced discretionary spending are considered the main barriers to domestic travel. In contrast, international travel continued to climb, with numbers tipped to reach record highs in 2025, when more than 10 million overseas arrivals are expected. To date, visitors from Asia have returned the fastest, with arrivals from Vietnam, Thailand, the Philippines and India already exceeding pre-pandemic levels. Other international markets, such as New Zealand, China, Japan, Singapore, Canada, the US and Britain, are forecast to return to 2019 numbers in 2025, while visitors from Europe are likely to take longer. That is attributed to negative consumer sentiment towards long-haul flights in Europe, where concern about carbon emissions and global warming is highest. Australian Travel Industry Association Chief Executive Dean Long said members were certainly seeing a slowdown in domestic travel, largely as a result of competition from international markets. An industry superannuation fund, UniSuper, is facing rising demands from members that adopt more rigorous and science-based decarbonisation targets. More than 1,650 people have signed a petition calling on the fund to strengthen its net zero emission target, and 370-plus academics have signed an open letter demanding the same as consumer and regulatory pressure rises on funds to act on their green claims. UniSuper, which is one of the most educated member bases in the industry due to its roots in the default fund, the UniSAR, has been under pressure from customers over its climate policies for several years. It updated its climate policies after a tense standoff in 2020. The fund pitches itself as one of the most sustainably focused in the $3.5 trillion retirement savings sector, imposing net zero targets on its broader portfolio as well as ESG-specific options. But UniSuper customers who signed the petition and open letter are demanding the fund adopt short-term, medium-term and net zero targets in the next 12 months that are based on science-based and Paris Agreement-aligned benchmarks. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission is planning a crackdown on consumer contracts for anything from airline tickets to houses, with a former insider tipping prosecutions before Christmas. In changes hailed as the biggest shift in consumer law for 20 years, standard form contracts which include unfair terms can now attract fines of up to $50 million after years of light-touch regulation. Until November 9th, courts could only declare terms of the contract unfair and void, a regime which the ACCC said had failed to lead to meaningful change. However, the landmark case against Qantas over cancelled flights has led to a late flurry of changes to standard contracts issued by insurance companies, builders, telcos, airline ticket agencies and transport companies. In indication of likely areas of concern, matters recently pursued by the regulator include clauses that gave Horticultural Wholesale and Nutrano absolute discretion to change produce specifications and allow Great Co Farms to terminate agreements and withhold part payments. In 2022, Fujifilm had 38 terms in its small business contracts providing for automatic renewal, excessive exit fees and unilateral price increases. No reliance clauses requiring agreement by one party that has read extraneous documents that included liability for other representations were also found to be unfair. Other clauses commonly seen in construction industry contracts, which may be considered unfair, are unreasonable time bars and termination for convenience clauses without appropriate compensation. University of New South Wales Associate Professor Rob Nichols, a former partner at Gilbert and Tobin, who worked alongside current ACCC Chair Gina Cass-Gottlieb for 12 years after 2 years at ASIC, said he expected the first announcement of a prosecution before Christmas. And disposable vapes won't be allowed into Australia from New Year's Day under the federal government's bold plans to stop a new generation becoming addicted to nicotine. Australia's ambition to become the first country to limit vaping to people with a prescription will be rolled out in several phases next year, starting with an import ban on single-use products and an expanded access scheme for medical use from the start of 2024. Health Minister Mark Butler's crackdown aims to stop a thriving black market that imports millions of flavoured disposable vapes from China and sells them to young Australians on social media or under the counter in convenience stores. Expanded access to vaping prescriptions will be a vital part of the reforms because legal pathways must become easier to stop people seeking out products on the black market. All doctors and nurse practitioners will be able to prescribe vapes from the new year, but the success of the scheme will rely on a shift in approach from medical professionals who have been largely unwilling to prescribe vapes as a smoking cessation tool. Health and police ministers agreed to the changes at a meeting last week. Further changes that will apply from March include a ban on people importing their own vaping products and on the import of all non-therapeutic vapes. Vape importers will also have to obtain a permit from the federal government and notify the Therapeutic Goods Administration that their products comply with new standards. The new product standards, to be strengthened in 2024, will limit flavours, reduce maximum nicotine concentration and require pharmaceutical packaging, but businesses will be given a transition period to comply. Government will also introduce legislation next year to prevent the manufacturing, advertising, supply and commercial possession of non-therapeutic and single-use vapes in Australia. A national vaping working group will oversee the plan, while $25 million will go to the Australian Border Force and $56.9 million to the Therapeutic Goods Administration over 2 years to enforce a crackdown. Butler's decision to pursue an all-out ban was opposed by industry groups, who called on the government to reap tax revenue from commercial vape sales instead, and by harm-reducing experts, who warned prohibition rarely works. Enforcement experts have also warned the ban will be difficult to police, given the scale of the black market and the fact that vapes alongside illicit tobacco have become a lucrative market for organised crime groups because they offer high profit margins with smaller penalties than the narcotics. And less than one-third of the top Australian companies have adopted science-based climate targets, with a major green body warning companies face a crackdown with tougher disclosure rules set to start in July 2024. Ahead of the COP28 climate summit starting in Dubai on November 30th, the Climate Leaders Coalition said only 29% of some of Australia's biggest companies had taken up Scope 3 emissions target, which are those produced outside a company's direct industrial processes. The CLC has instructed member companies to accelerate cuts to Scope 3 emissions or face significant commercial consequences, with strict new reporting standards mandating Scope 3 commitments and reporting from July 2024. The progress in elevating women into Australia's top corporate roles has stalled, despite the country's pay gap narrowing to the lowest in more than a decade. The average annual pay difference between men and women narrowed by $1,322 to $26,393, a drop of 1.1 percentage points since last year. It's the second largest annual decrease since the Workplace Gender Equality Agency began surveying employers in 2014 for its employer census, which this year covered 4.8 million workers. While the proportion of women in management has been increasing at every level, that doesn't include Chief Executive Officer, the WGEA report showed. Across the workforce, the proportion of female board members remained the same as 2022, at just 34%, while 22% of CEOs were women. The agency's report comes as Australia takes steps to confront its wage disparity, which is slightly below the OECD average. The nation ranks 26th on the 2023 Global Gender Gap Index.
which is topped by Iceland, Finland, Norway and New Zealand. Starting next year, individual companies with 100 workers or more will be required to report their gender pay gap data on a yearly basis as part of new income equality legislation. Currently, results are only disclosed by industry rather than by company. And that's it for this week. And next week, I'll be talking to Ben Fitzgerald, the CEO of business payment service Zella, and I'll be talking to financial analyst Tim Buckley, the Director of Climate Energy Finance, about the Brookfield EIG battle to take over Origin. For the most exclusive access to Lynn economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, catch me on Facebook, in Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. For the most exclusive access to Lynn economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business on the Apple Podcast Store or on my website, leongettler.com. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongettler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week and looking forward to bringing Talking Business next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.